My name is Jim Turner, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Rick, and thank you for telling half my story. That was really awesome. First things first, my sobriety date is August 1st, 2007. The only reason I know that is my wife had to tell me. You'll understand why later. My home group is the Lumpkin Street Noontimers Group in Athens. And they meet at the noon hour on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And if you're ever in Athens around lunchtime on those days and you want to come to a really good AA group, come to that one. At any given time, there's 200 to 300 years of sobriety sitting in that room. And that's why it was my first home group and my only home group, because I wanted to learn from them. I have a great sponsor. His name is David Kidd. Some of y'all know him. And the reason I picked David to be my sponsor, if you look in the pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship, I think it's maybe the second or third page, and it's in the part about how do you choose a sponsor. And I think it says something to the effect of, there are no specific rules, but try to find someone who's been at least a year away from their last drink and seems to be enjoying sobriety. And I picked David because of all the people in Athens that I knew at the time, he was enjoying his sobriety more than anyone else. And David is a funny guy. He's a smart aleck. He's always this far from being in trouble, but he never manages to cross the line. And I just felt, you know, maybe he can teach me how to do that. And because I kind of needed that. So, you know, I was up at Woodstock of the South, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, and I was listening to Polly Pistol give her talk. And Polly said something that really resonated with me. She said, the chains of alcoholism were too soft to be felt until they became too strong to be broken. And that really struck a chord of me. I thought, man, that's exactly the way it felt. Exactly the way it felt. Because my drinking career lasted 31 years. And the first 24, 25 of them were actually not that bad. You know, there was minimal consequences, a lot of fun. You know, I didn't see what the big deal was. Now, a lot of that had to do with the fact that before I became an alcoholic, I was a workaholic. And if I had to get up in the morning and put on a coat and tie and go to an office, I could maintain. At least back in those days. And the problem arose, my wife and I met working for the same international chemical company up in the Raleigh area. And there were indications, however, in those 25 years that alcohol might become a problem for me, and I'll give you a little example. In 1992, we were dating. We hadn't been married yet. We were still dating. But we were living together. And if that offends anyone, I'm sorry. Anyway, we rented a house. We were both really hardworking individuals, and so we would take 1 week of vacation every year, and that was the only time off we would take. And so we rented this house in the Outer Banks. I think it would maybe even been on Ocracoke. And so we got over there, we rented it for a week. It was a really neat house, beautiful house right on the beach. Now, I had a deck out the back overlooking the water, and we got there and got up on Monday morning, and I said, hey, honey, why don't I make us a pitcher of Bloody Marys, and we'll go sit out on the deck and watch the waves roll in and take it all in. She said, great. So I made a pitcher of Bloody Marys, and we got out on the deck and started sitting there. We had the two dogs with us, and we just had the nicest time, nice conversation, and she said, you know, I think I'm going to go in and fix some breakfast. Can I fix you some? And I said, you know, I think I'm okay. I'm kind of good just sitting out here having a Bloody Mary. You know, it's the perfect day. There's not a cloud in the sky. I mean, I'm going to just hang out here for a while. And she said, okay. About lunchtime, she came out and she said, I'm going to make some sandwiches for lunch. Would you like me to make you a sandwich for lunch? And I said, no, man. I'm good. I'm really good, you know. Because I don't know how many pitchers I'd mixed up at that point. I do remember at one point I ran out of tomato juice, but that was not a hindrance. So about 3:30, she comes out and she says, "Honey," she said, "you know, you're getting a lot of sun. I'm afraid maybe you should put some sunscreen on." And I've been drinking all day, and I look at her and I go, "Real men don't use sunscreen." You can probably tell this is not going to end well. By 5:30, I wake up. I come to, more accurately. And I remember I promised to take her out to the seafood restaurant tonight, and she's going to kill me if I don't do it. And so I get up, and I mean, I go into the bathroom, and I'm very, very close resemblance to a lobster. I mean, I am in excruciating pain. I remember getting in the shower and turning the water on, and it felt like hot needles hitting my skin. And so anyway, I dried off as gingerly as possible and got dressed, and I'm kind of walking, you know, like this, trying not to move at all when I walk. And I walk out in the den, and she's standing there like this with her arms crossed, and she says, "It's a good thing you're a real man, or I bet that hurt like hell." Timothy McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City the next morning, and I had skin poisoning, and I couldn't go back outside the entire week, and I got to sit there and watch that on the news. That was my reward for having a good time with Bloody Marys. And, you know, that should have been an indicator. I mean, you know, if I was a writer, I might call that foreshadowing. But it should have been an indicator, but it wasn't. And what happened was, in 1996, she and I both resigned from our jobs and moved to Athens and started our own business, which was great for a while. The problem is, when I don't have to get up and go to an office with a coat and tie on in the morning, I have a tendency to drink a little bit more at night, you know, particularly when the office is downstairs in the house and my wife's my business partner. So anyway, I started just drinking a little bit more at night, a little bit more at night, a little bit more at night. And at one point she looked at me and she said, "You know, you're drinking a good bit more than you used to." And I said, "You know, you're right about that, honey. I think what I'll do is I'll limit myself to 2 drinks at night." And so I just changed from a rocks glass to a Collins glass, and then ultimately to an iced tea glass. But by God, I only had 2. And what happened was, I would get up in the morning, you know, to go to work, and I was starting to get more and more hungover. And I don't really care for pain too much. And so I may be an alcoholic, but I'm not an idiot. And I remembered those Bloody Marys. So what I would do in the morning was I would just start drinking a Bloody Mary. But I had to be very secretive, because Barbara would flip out if she saw me doing this. So I'd get up really early and go in there and mix me a drink, and, you know. And what it did was, it sort of turned into this hangover deferment program. Because what happens is, about 11 o'clock, the hangover comes back. And so you got to do it again. And then about 3:30, the hangover comes back. And so slowly, over a number of years, what happened was, I started drinking around the clock. And you know, it never seemed one time that that was strange. That, you know, and it says in the book, you know, the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. And well, of course it does. That's all I knew. And so I started to drink around the clock, and the tomato juice had to go. That was taking entirely too much time. So it basically just became vodka straight out of the bottle. And I know no one in here ever did the morning drink thing, you know. But it got to a point where that was the only time it would ever make me high. That it was always, it had become work. It had become drudgery. And my wife in those days was suffering from what I like to call untreated Al-Anonism. And so what she would do, she would find, I had bottles stashed all over the house. I'm a page 22 guy, you know. I mean, I had bottles stashed all over the house, and she would find them and dump them out. Or, this is what I loved, she would dump out most of the vodka and fill it back up with water like I wasn't going to notice. And what happened was I became physically addicted to the alcohol. And I couldn't go more than a couple of 3 hours without a drink. And I'd start the shaking and the sweating, and it was awful. I also kind of got away from bathing. Personal hygiene became very tertiary in my life. I quit brushing my hair. I quit brushing my teeth. I was just nasty. And apparently at night I would snore. And she took exception to that. And so one day she told me, she said, "You know, honey, I think it'd be a really good idea if you moved upstairs into the guest bedroom." And I thought, awesome. But see, I'm waking up at 2 or 3 in the morning and shaking like hell, and I'm trying to hide a bottle of vodka under our bed, you know. And I figure, okay, I go upstairs, I'm good to go. So I moved upstairs, and we had this kind of a black lab chow mix dog. His name was Mosby, and he was like 95 pounds. And so me and Mosby moved upstairs. And he loved it because he got to sleep on the bed, and he wasn't the worst smelling thing in the room. So there was this one Friday, June 29th, 2007. My wife made a major score on my stash. She dumped out a bunch of vodka. And I was looking at it going, oh my God, this is brutal. And I said, I have got to go to the liquor store and get more because there ain't no way I'm going to make it through the day, much less the weekend. So I got in the car and drove to the liquor store and ended up, long story short, getting a DUI on the way home. And the officer said, "Mr. Turner, would you be willing to take a breathalyzer?" And I said, "You betcha." And I didn't know it, but he turned the machine off when it passed 0.3. And this was at 2 o'clock. I mean, good thing they didn't catch me at 5. It would have been really bad. Later on at the jail, I did a breathalyzer, and I blew a 0.38. And I got a DUI because, and I always figured it's like, you know, if you're going to get a DUI, you may as well be 4 times the legal limit, right? No sense this .09 stuff. And what happened was it scared the hell out of me, and my wife came and bailed me out. And I got home from the jail, and I first thing I did was turn up a bottle of vodka. I couldn't take it. I'd started to detox, and it was awful. My life was a wreck at that point. It was horrible. It was dark. It was lonely. I didn't have any more friends. No one called me. Our friends quit going out to eat with us at night because there was really no telling what Jim was going to do. And so they just quit calling. And so here I am with my wife and me, and we ain't getting along very good at all at this point, as you might imagine. And it just became a very dreary existence. And I actually got to the point where I thought, you know, I think I'll just drink myself to death, and probably everybody will be happy about it. Because at that point, my hair was falling out. My liver enzymes were elevated. I was actually 20 pounds lighter than I am now, which is like skeleton with skin type stuff. It was bad. And I remember I got a lawyer and I said, "What do you want me to do?" He said, "This is really bad." He said that I ended up with a 0.38, I think I said. He said, "This is really bad. You have got to do something proactive. The judge is going to have a field day with you, man." And he said, "So what I want you to do is quit drinking, and I want you to go and get a DUI certificate. Take DUI school. Let's be proactive here." And I said, "Okay." So I quit drinking. But about 6 months prior to this, I had convinced my doctor that I was suffering from a very severe benzodiazepine deficiency. And he had prescribed me Ativans. And I tell you what, I would take 2 Ativans and drink a quart of vodka a day. I don't remember anything, you know. I mean, I have no idea what happened during the entire month of April 2007. It's just gone. So I did that. I stopped drinking. And you'd probably have another speaker tonight if it hadn't have been for the Ativans, because benzos are wonderful detox drugs. So I did the DUI school. I stopped drinking for 10 days. And I'm one of these people, you may know some people like this. I'm one of these people where I don't really need to know a whole lot about anything to be an expert. So I stopped drinking for 10 days, and I thought, I can't possibly be an alcoholic. Because I don't really know what an alcoholic is, but I know they can't go 10 days without drinking. So I'm going to have me a cocktail tonight with my wife. And I made myself, here's the solemn oath, I made myself a promise. I am not for any reason ever going to get behind the wheel of a car because I have a DUI and it's not been settled yet. And I am not going to drink and drive ever again. That's crazy. 4 days later, I got a quart of vodka in me and I'm driving the car again. And if that's not powerlessness, I don't know what is. Then on July 31st, 2007, I was over at my dad's house working. He was out of town. I was working over his liquor cabinet, and I got in my truck, and I drove home. And I got home, and I got out of the truck, and I looked, and there was a dent, and I had no idea where it come from. And I thought, huh, I wonder where that came from. And it dawned on me, I had no recall of driving home, and I thought, wonder what I hit. And I thought, my God, I hope I didn't hit a dog or something. Or what if I hit a human? What if I hit a child? And I came out of a blackout, and that was my moment of clarity. I mean, I would, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd give that drunk a 5. It was no big deal, but it dawned on me for the first time that my drinking was affecting other people and could have very dramatic and deadly consequences. And I said, this has got to stop. I can't live like this. I mean, can't live with it, can't live without it. You'll know what that feels like. And so the only place I'd been able to stay sober was in the Clark County Jail, and I'm not real thrilled about that place at the time, and so I decided to put myself in treatment. So I go into treatment, and the first day in treatment, they say, get in the car. We just had our lunch, and they say, get in the car. And I go, where are we going? And they say, we're going to AA. And I said, oh, no. No, no one mentioned any AA stuff to me when I signed into this place. And they said, Jim, look, we can detox you, we can stabilize you, we can educate you, but if you're going to find long-term sobriety, it's going to require AA. And I'm like, damn, I'm paying you people a bunch of money. You're supposed to, and finally it was like, get in the car. And I didn't really fight them that much because I didn't really have the gift of desperation. What I had was the gift of exhaustion. I was so tired of drinking around the clock and hurting and the pain and just everything about my life was a mess. And so I just said, okay. And what happened was I didn't like AA at first. I know that never happens to anyone. I think it was about 2 weeks in, I got really down to a weakened point, and I actually started listening to what they were saying in the meetings. And it was interesting because people used to ask me, what is wrong with you, man? Why don't you quit drinking? You know, what is going on with you? You know, and I'd be like, I don't know. And they'd persist, and I would finally just look at them and I'd say, you don't understand. That was my primary excuse to everybody. And what I learned pretty quickly about the people in AA, we are the only people on the planet that do understand. And so that last line of defense was no longer valid for me. Within 3 weeks of going to AA, I didn't realize it, but I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'm just a garden variety alcoholic. So at this treatment center, the deal is get your home group, get your sponsor, start working steps, and then you can graduate. Don't do any of those things, you're going to be here a while. And my case manager, who is a guy that is a very dear friend of mine now, I hated his guts at the time. He was like, nah, 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 nah. And I'm like, Joe, man, I can go home and get yelled at. You know, you got to stop this stuff. So I'm very compliant at this point. I get a sponsor, I get a home group, and I start working the steps. Now, I remember I was at the Cobb House one day, which was a clubhouse we used to have in Athens. And I was sitting there reading, you know, my faculties were starting to come back a little bit. And I was reading the steps on the wall. And I remember reading step two, and it came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. And I'm sitting there going, you know what? Y'all aren't fooling me at all. I know what this is leading up to. And then I cheated and read step three. And I saw the God word. And what had happened to me was, when I was a little boy, I'd been molested by a priest. And this was in the early 1960s. And it was not cool to say anything about it back then. And I came home and I told my parents what had happened. And they said, you can never tell anyone about this. This will bring shame to our family. And they were doing the best they could. I'm not upset about it. But I stuffed that deep inside of me. And now I know it's called a resentment. At the time, I just thought, you know, and see, this is the way my brain works. I don't get a resentment towards the sick old guy. I get a resentment towards all of organized religion and anything that has to do with it. So I spent the next 45 years of my life with no God, no Jesus, no nothing. And I was perfectly okay with that. So when I got in there, my case manager, he said, Jim, he said, you seem to be confused. See, you're thinking that AA is a religious program, and it's actually a spiritual program. And I said, what the hell's the difference? And he said, come with me. So he takes me in his office, and he prints this thing off the internet. And I knew that because it came from the internet, it had to be true. It was a statement by the Dalai Lama, and it was comparing and contrasting spirituality and religion. And I can't quote it exactly, but it said something like, religion I take to be associated with one faith tradition or another, usually involving some sort of metaphysical being, prayer, dogma, ritual. Spirituality, on the other hand, I take to be associated with those basic qualities of the human spirit. Like love, like compassion, like forgiveness, like honesty, like patience, like tolerance, a sense of responsibility, a sense of harmony. And he said, while there's no reason why these qualities can't be developed to a great extent, there is also no reason why they can't be done without religion. And I said, that is why sometimes I believe that religion is something we could perhaps do without, but what we cannot do without are these basic human qualities of the spirit. And when I read that, it opened the door for me that far. I said, that sounds cool to me. I can do that. So I remember doing my fourth step. I learned some incredibly valuable information about myself. I'd been going to therapists for 30 years. And all I learned from it was how to write big checks to them and how to say big words. It didn't help me understand anything about myself. And I remember when I did my fourth and fifth step, I learned that I have a fairly high opinion of myself. It's probably unrealistic at that. I think I'm smarter than everybody else. I think I'm better than everybody else. And when I was younger, I thought I was better looking than everybody else. And that's been causing me problems my whole life. My sponsor used the seven deadly sins. And I tell you what, by the time we got through with my fist up, I was damn grateful there was only seven of them. We did step six and seven sitting in the cab of my pickup truck outside his home group one night. And I started to make my eight-step list. And we sat down, went through it, and he set me loose on making my amends. I had 36 people on my amends list. I found all of them but nine. I did my dad and my wife first. I did the people closest to me first because those are the people I hurt the worst. And I made good, formal, solid amends. My sponsor would not let me say, I'm sorry. He said, you tell them you were wrong. And that's what I did. I did not use the word, I'm sorry. I said, now I regret it. But I did not use the words, I'm sorry. He goes, they know you're sorry, Jim. They know it. So I got down to nine people, and I could not find these nine people. And it was one night, Barbara had actually invited me back downstairs, and I was sleeping in the big bed again, because I was bathing and brushing my hair and my teeth and doing everything I needed to do. And the phone rang one night, and I opened one eye and I looked over on the caller ID. It said Athens Regional Medical Center. And I remember distinctly thinking, this can't possibly be good news. And I answered the phone, and it was the emergency room calling, and they said, your father has had a massive brain hemorrhage, and you need to get down here as quickly as possible. And I hung the phone up. And see, my dad was, he was the last remaining relative I had on the earth. My mom died in 01. And so my dad was, I don't have any brothers and sisters, my dad was all I had left, and I didn't have a driver's license because of that little DUI issue thing, and so Barbara got up, bless her heart, and she drove me down to the Athens Regional. And as we went into the emergency room, he was slipping into a coma. It was about a 6 to 7 centimeter brain hemorrhage right in the middle of his brain. And so there was nothing they could do. They would destroy more tissue trying to operate than they could save. And so what we did was we started this waiting game, and they moved him up to neuro ICU. And at this point in time, I'm 4 days shy of a yellow chip. And in Athens, a yellow chip is 6 months. And I'm not mentally or emotionally or spiritually prepared for this kind of stuff. It was interesting because this was on a Thursday night, Friday morning when it happened, and so I stayed at the hospital with my dad that entire day, and I didn't get to my home group, and my phone started ringing that afternoon. Where are you? Are you okay? What's going on? Where are you? And word started to spread around, and at one point I had to send Barbara home to get the charger for my phone because I couldn't keep a charge on the battery because I was getting so many phone calls from AA members, whom I had not known even 6 months. It was the first time I started to really get a sense of what the fellowship is like in here. I remember at 10 o'clock that night, I was still on the phone, and Barbara comes up and she's like, who are you talking to now? And I'm like, I don't know, honey, it's these damn alcoholics. They just keep calling. I don't know what's going on here. You know, they won't leave me alone, you know. Bless her heart, she took me to a meeting every day for 6 straight days. And I would go and recharge my batteries, and you guys would say, you're going to be okay, Jim, you're going to be okay. And I would go back to the hospital, and I had his living will in my pocket. And I knew exactly what it said. It said, if I become capacitated, no oxygen, no water, no food, no meds. Pull the plug. And I didn't want to do that. And he was dating this lady. And I went up to her and I said, you know, I think I need to get him to remove the life support. And she looked at me and she said, you can't kill him. You can't kill him. You can't do that to him. And I thought, man, I could have gone my whole life without hearing that. And so what happened was he started to go downhill. He got pneumonia and his kidneys started to shut down. They shot him full of antibiotics and brought him back. And at that time, I was praying twice a day. I was praying at night, thank you for keeping me sober. I was praying in the morning, please keep me sober today. That was about the extent of my spiritual life. And so I started praying like 10 times a day. I need some insight. I need some help here. I don't even know who you are, but I need some help from you, you know. And at one point, it became real clear to me that I needed to do what the living will said. And so I walked in. And I went to the neurosurgeon and I said, this has got to stop. And so he went in and they removed everything. And as the needles ticked down, my wife and me and my sponsor sat in there while my dad passed away. The reason I share that with you, remember those 9 people that I couldn't find that were on my amends list? During those 6 days, all 9 of those people came to the hospital. And I said, you know, there's an empty waiting room over here. I need about 5 minutes of your time. I've got something I need to say to you. And they said, sure. When my dad's heart stopped beating, I was done with my amends. Now, for a guy, I was never an atheist. That's a lot of work. But for a guy who's an agnostic with a bad attitude, for that to happen had to be a little bit more than coincidence. So I said, okay. I really wondered if I had done the right thing. You know, my life became crazy with the IRS and wills, and it was nuts. But I always wondered if I did the right thing. And so a year later, this young lady asked me to speak at her birthday at the Athens Young People's Group. And so I go, sure, I do that. You know, when people ask me to speak, I go, yes, I'll do that. So anyway, I went to the Athens Young People's Group. I'd never been there before. And this young lady was getting a 7-year medallion that night. And so I got through telling my story, and I told them just what I told y'all. And I sat down, and her dad comes up to give her her medallion. And he's standing there at the podium. I'm sitting in the front row where Mitch is, and we're all going out to eat afterwards, and I've got a year and a half of sobriety, and I'm kind of impatient, and I want him to go ahead and get this over with so we can go eat, you know. And he's standing there at the podium, and tears start coming down his cheeks. And I'm like, man, it's 7 years. What's the big deal? Give her the medallion. Let's go. And he looks at me and he says, I don't know if you know this or not, but I was one of your dad's doctors. And he came to me 2 days before he had that brain hemorrhage. And he said to me, if something happens to me, I hope my son has the courage to pull the plug. Now, I'm sitting there crying. See, nowhere else but in Alcoholics Anonymous does this stuff happen. You can't make that stuff up. It was unbelievable. So, I want to finish talking a little bit about service, the 12th step. I love the 12th step. You know, we have this circle and triangle. It's right in front of me. Recovery, unity, and service, the three legacies. And to me, the 12th step encompasses all three of those legacies. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. That's recovery. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics. That's service. And practice these principles in all our affairs. That's unity. I was a coffee maker at my home group. And this lady came up to me one day and she said, we need an alternate GSR. Would you be our alternate GSR? And I said, I don't have enough time. I said, don't you have to have 2 years? And she said, yeah. And I said, I don't have enough time. And she said, yeah, but you will. And so I guess the group felt it was safe. And so they made me alternate GSR. And I remember the last time I got released from the Clark County Jail, there was this big long ramp that you go out to an outer gate. And I was walking up that ramp. And I remember saying to myself, I was about 2 months sober. I'd gone back in to serve out the balance of that sentence. And I'd gone back in. I was coming up the ramp. My wife was in the parking lot, you know, waiting to pick me up. And it dawned on me that day, you know, the only time my wife's ever been to jail is when she's getting me out. Anyway, I'm walking up the ramp and I'm sitting there telling myself, you know, I'm sober. I will never come back in a place like this again as long as I live. Which apparently my higher power felt was hilarious. Because a year later, I'm hanging out outside my sponsor's home group, smoking cigarettes. I was back when I smoked, and this guy comes up to me and he goes, hey man, want to help us carry meetings into the Clark County Jail? And in my mind, I go, why in the hell would I ever want to do that? And out of my mouth comes, okay. So I filled out the paperwork. The jail lost it. I loved the fact that my Social Security number was floating around the Clark County Jail. But I filled out another set of paperwork, turned it in, and they approved me. And I started going into the jail. And I immediately fell passionately in love with it. And I started to go in every time they would let me go in. See, I'm one of these people that if you chain me to a desk and it's the night to go to the jail, guess what? The desk is going with me. It became that important. I was sitting in a district meeting one time, and our district corrections rep had been elected alternate DCM, and so they asked for, are there any announcements at the end of the meeting? And he said, yeah, he said, I can't be district corrections rep anymore since I'm going to be alternate DCM. Jim's going to take over for me. And I thought, really? Okay. And then I guess it was maybe a few months later, I picked up my two-year chip in my home group. This is the blue one, not the medallion, the blue one, the day of my birthday. They said, are there any announcements? And our GSR says, yep, effective immediately, I'm stepping down as GSR, and Jim will be taking over as your new GSR. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm starting to see how this works in AA. So anyway, I came down to Macon for my first assembly, and I remember David Schaffner and Dick Anderson did the GSR DCM thing, and I was so overwhelmed by it. When I went back to Athens on Sunday, I cried the whole way. I was in the car by myself. I just cried the whole way home. It was the most amazing thing, and I just absolutely fell in love with service. And so this was 2010, was the next year, and we were hosting the prepaid in Athens that year as well. And so I'm sitting out there in the hall, like kind of like I was doing today, signing people up for the prepaid. And Patty comes walking down the hall, and I see her coming, and I go, oh, there's Patty. I think she's the delegate. I'm not really sure what that is, but I think she's the delegate. And she stops, and she goes, come here. Come here. And, of course, I'm freaking out because I go, I didn't do anything. What would she possibly want to speak to me about, you know? And I walked over there, and she said, I'd like to know if you would be willing to serve as area co-chair for corrections. And I said, I don't think I have enough time. And knowing Patty, you know, she always has her service manual. She whips it out, and she goes, well, let's just check on that, shall we, Jim? She goes, how much time you got? I got a three-year medallion. It's still warm in my pocket. And she goes, up 2 to 3 years of continuous sobriety in the state of Georgia. Sorry. And I said, okay, I'll do it. Well, that freaked me out. So anyway, I got to serve 2 years as area chair or area co-chair and 2 years as area chair. And that was probably, at that time, the coolest thing I'd ever done in my life. I tell you one thing, those 4 years, I went into more men and women's prisons in this state than I ever felt necessary. But it was really great, and I got to work with some great people, and I just fell in love with service in AA even more. And I think it was at the DCM planning meeting in 2013, Patty comes up to me, and she says, you're rotating out as area chair this year, aren't you? And I said, no, ma'am, I got one more year. I said, it kind of seems like I should be, but I got one more year. And she says, okay, well, never mind. And I'm like, Patty, you can't do that. You can't just come up to me and ask me a question, go, oh, never mind. I said, what's on your mind? And she said, I'm going to be chairing the host committee for the International Convention, and I was going to see if you wanted to serve on the committee with me. And I said, yes. And she said, you got another year. And I said, I don't care. I said, Tim is my co-chair. He's not going to learn any younger how to do this. I'm going to start turning stuff over to him anyway. I can do it. And she said, are you sure? And she said, think about it. And so she said, I'll call you in a month. And she called me. And she said, have you thought about it? And I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to do it. And I said, Patty, I said, this thing is never going to be this close again in my lifetime. It's in my backyard. I'd be an idiot not to do this. And so we started meeting, and Tom and I were her two co-chairs, and it was really a neat experience. And I think it was August of 2014, when I was the area chair for corrections, there was a lady named Eva Sanchez who was working the corrections desk at GSO. And Eva called me on the phone, and she says, hey, Jim, this is Eva Sanchez from GSO, and I only know one Eva on the whole planet, but she always felt necessary to tell me exactly who she was. I said, hey, Eva, how you doing? And she said, I'm great. How are you? And I said, I'm good. She said, I want to talk to you about something, but before we go forward, you need to promise me that you're never going to tell anyone about what we talk about. And I'm thinking, what? The hell? I said, okay, sure, Eva, no problem. She said, I'm going to do something that's never been done in Alcoholics Anonymous before. She said, I would like to see if we can get an inmate from Georgia released for the day to speak at the International Convention. And I thought, my God, I'm on the phone with a crazy woman. I was like, Eva, really? You know, I mean, I've never heard of this sort of thing that the Department of Corrections ever even thinking about this, much less doing it. And I said, but you know what? If you want to try, I'm your boy. And so we started working on this thing. And it took us a couple of months, but we identified an inmate that we thought would be good. And we approached him. It was a guy I'd actually met in 2011. And I remember I was sitting in it was a county prison in Jackson County. And I remember him coming in for his first meeting. And it was not pretty. It was not pretty. And I got to know him, and he ultimately became the GSR. That's actually a registered group, that prison group. And he became the GSR of that group. And he and I became buddies. And so I'd always remembered that you know, we were friends. You know, he did a good job running the meetings. And so anyway, we started trying to pull this off. And I would go to the meetings, like the host committee meetings, and I would feel like crap because I'm sitting there and I can't tell Patty and Tom or anybody what I'm doing. And whenever we would have supper with the people from GSO, even and I would sneak off over into the corner and compare notes and talk, you know, you think it's going to work, you know. And it was really interesting because he agreed to do it. And the guy, how many of y'all were in the dome that morning? A lot. Okay. So the reason that I thought Jason was the right guy is he did the one thing that I suspect each and every one of us was horrified and terrified of doing. In a blackout, he took another human being's life in a car accident. And I just thought that's unbelievable. So Eva calls me one day and she goes, has Jason worked the steps? And I go, I don't know. And she goes, Jim, we can't have someone speaking at the International Convention that's not worked the steps. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I see your point, Eva. And I said, guess I'll get busy, huh? So the work became divided. My job was to get him through the steps. Her job was to figure out how to make the whole thing happen. So I felt like I had the much easier deal. And so on the weekends that the host committee would not meet, I would drive. He was at Walker State Prison, which is like 15 miles south of Chattanooga. So I would drive up to Walker and go in, and we would sit in the visitation lobby of the prison for 6 hours and do step work. And it was funny because I would always wear my Georgia Department of Corrections volunteer badge, and the correctional officers would always go, come on up to the front of the line, sir. Come on up to the front of the line. And this lady one time, she goes, why does he get to go to the front of the line? And the officer said, because he's a pastor. I'm biting my lip to keep from laughing, but I've made it a policy. I don't ever correct correctional officers. I'd go up to the front of the line. They'd let me in, you know. And it was interesting because Jason carried about as much guilt and shame as anyone I have ever run across. There was this dark cloud over him because of what happened. And y'all know how this goes, right? I think one of the greatest gifts we get in Alcoholics Anonymous is when we're working with somebody and we're taking them through the steps and their eyes are dead. And all of a sudden, at some point, there starts to be a little flicker of light. And it gets brighter and brighter and brighter. And before you know it, their eyes are shining. It is absolutely amazing. And I think working with Jason, I don't think I've ever seen it that dramatic and that distinct before, because it turned his life around. That was the greatest example of the power of the 12 steps I've ever seen. It was absolutely amazing. And you know, when we were doing his fourth and fifth step and his eighth and ninth step, he would sit there in that prison, and it's not cool to cry in prison. Y'all get that. And he would fight back the tears when we would be talking. And it would literally break my heart to watch that young man, the courage that he had. And he did that step work like nothing I've seen. So anyway, Eva at one point, I guess it was probably May or June, calls me and she says, I got to print the program today. I need to know. Do you think it's going to happen? And I'm going, I don't know, Eva. And she said, well, do I put his name in or not? And I said, Eva, I said, I got a really good feeling about this. And I said, besides, if God wants him in that dome, there's nothing you and I can do to screw it up. And if he doesn't, there's nothing you and I can do to make it happen. I said, I don't think it's going to be a problem. I said, I would print. She said, okay. And she says, if you got this wrong, I'm going to tell everybody you told me to do this. And she later told me, if he gives a really bad story, I'm going to tell everybody that you're a sponsor. I said, what if he gives a good one? She goes, well, I'll tell him then too. So anyway, it ended up working. Y'all know. He showed up there. That Sunday morning, Patty and I walked from the hotel to the dome together. And Patty knew about what was going on because Eva had slipped up over the phone, I think, and said something. So Patty and I were walking and we were talking about what was going to happen. And at one point, Eva had said, She said, does your wife know what you're doing? And I said, no, she just thinks I'm going through the steps with another inmate. No big deal. And she says, well, I think you need to tell Barbara what's going on. And I said, well, Eva, I don't really have to. She goes, tell her what's going on. I said, yes, ma'am. So I told Barbara, I said, so we got this thing going on. And Barbara looks at me and she goes, I just thought you were crazy. I know you're crazy now. You and Eva, I don't think y'all should be hanging around each other that much, you know? So anyway, we got there that morning and we went in the green room and Tom was there. And my job that morning was to keep Jason calm. And I'm thinking, the hell's going to keep me calm? You know? Because we had spent a great deal of time talking about the psychological impact that this could have on him. Taking him out of prison, speaking in front of 35,000, however many there were in the dome that morning, and then going right back. And so I was very concerned. But, you know, he and I sat. We prayed together. We laughed. We talked. I told him, I said, Jason, I said, this ain't even your talk, man. This is God's talk. All you got to do is run your mouth. I've seen you do that before. You got this. No problem. And I said, but you need to remember one thing. When you go up there, you need to remember to breathe. It is the first thing you did when you came into this world. It will be the last thing you do when you depart. It has to be the one constant in your life. You have to remember to breathe. And when he got up to the podium and said, hi, I'm Jason, I'm an alcoholic, I was like, crap, he forgot to breathe, you know. It was like he, you know, I know him. I know him. And anyway, he gave the talk he gave, and there was not a dry eye in the dome that I'm aware of. It was an amazing experience. And so Patty and Tom and I got to go up on the stage afterwards, and as we were walking out, as the last big meeting closed, I walked out right beside Jason, and we were going backstage, and I looked at him and I said, that is the most courageous thing I've ever seen a human being do. And I said, you knocked it out of the park, man. And I had told him there was this little timer on the floor, digital countdown timer from 20 minutes. I said, how much time was left on that thing when you finished? He said, 11 seconds. I said, you're good. I said, but I got to tell you something, man. The next time you tell your story in AA, it's all downhill from here, buddy. So GSO was having an ice cream social for all the volunteers afterwards. And so I finally made my way out of the dome and got up there. And I was looking for Barbara because I know she was in there in the dome. I didn't know where she was sitting with a sponsee and his wife. And I hadn't seen her since like 6:30 that morning. And so I got to the, and we're in this big room, and I'm looking around trying to find her. And I see her across the room, and we catch each other's eye, and she comes running to me. And we just embrace. And I started sobbing, and she started sobbing. And she said, "I am so proud of Jason, and I am so proud of you." I have never experienced a moment of closeness with another human being like that moment right there. That, to me, was what it was all about. We just sat there and cried together. We were both so happy and so relieved. And it was a wonderful experience. And it was a very different international convention for me. I think everybody on the host committee was worried about this exit and that exit, and, you know, what are we going to do about this, and what are we going to do about that? And the consultants sometimes were challenging to work with, but I don't know. I just had this whole other thing going on, and it was a wonderful experience for me all the way around, you know. And without service and Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't get to experience any of that. You know, it just, it ain't happening. I always close with this story because I firmly believe we are not a glum lot. My wife and I guess when I was about 3 years sober, started getting asked to come into the treatment center where I work to tell our story together. We do it on Wednesday nights. It's called Family Night, and you got the clients, and you got their really, really freaked out family members that are with them, you know. And so the format is the thing is, it's a 2-hour meeting. For the first hour, we tell our story, what we were like, what happened, what we're like now. But we go back and forth. And it's really kind of interesting because it's the same two people, it's the same house, but the stories are unbelievably different, right? Right? The perceptions, right? And then we take a break, and then they come back, and they get to ask us questions for an hour. And to me, that's my favorite part of the whole evening when we do this thing, because they ask some really awesome questions. And so one night we were in there, and this lady says, she says, "Okay, let me make sure I understand this." She said, "Jim, you don't drink anymore, and Barbara, you still drink." And Barbara said, "Yeah, a little bit, you know. And she said, "I have a question. How do you celebrate? How do you get together and celebrate?" I thought, that's a really good question. And so I said, we just celebrated our 18th anniversary. And I said, what we did was we went out to a restaurant, and she had 2 Cosmopolitans, and I had 2 Dr. Peppers with cherries in them. And I said, "See, she's not an alcoholic. When she drinks, no one dies. No one goes to jail. There's not an ambulance involved." And my wife says, and I quote, "You see, when Jim drinks alcohol, bad things happen to Jim. When I drink alcohol, good things happen to Jim." We do not have the market on crazy cornered. It's the Al-Anons are the ones you got to watch out for. My life today is so different, so very, very different. You know, I didn't want my old life back, and thank God I didn't get it back. I got a new life. It's amazing. I actually got asked to go to work at the treatment center that I went to. I now run the aftercare program. I'm doing that for my 5th year. And I absolutely love it. It's like they pay me to bitch at newcomers for not working steps. Like, really? You're going to pay me to do this? Cool. I had a marriage that was only a marriage on paper. There was no love. There was only hate. It was bad. Today, I have the best marriage of anyone I know. I have a marriage that's filled with love and compassion and courtesy and kindness and honor and respect. And my wife and I have a really, really, really good time together. It's a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me three really, really important things in my life. Value, meaning, and purpose. And for that, I will be forever grateful. Thank you all so much. Y'all have been great.
Hi, I'm Jason. I'm an alcoholic. In all my years of drinking, I was able to experience many different situations. But today, I must say, is the greatest of them all. When I woke up this morning, I was an inmate firefighter at Walker Faith and Character Based Prison. And God willing, when I lay my head down tonight, I will be at Walker Faith and Character Based Prison. But for today, I'm being able to share how I become happy, joyous, and free. I can't really blame the way I was brought up on the way that I turned out. Because other than when my father left for about a month or so, I had nothing but pleasant memories as a child. There was three of us. I had an older brother, my sister, and I. Our parents were very warm and loving people who wanted nothing more but to bring their kids up in a loving, respectable home. I would say as a child that I was a shy, timid, somewhat of a mother's boy. Having an older brother allowed me to be able to hang out with an older crew, and at that point, I began to feel a little out of place. At the age of 11, I was introduced to alcohol. And when I took that first drink, I realized it made me feel like I'd fit in, that I was a lot more outspoken. I knew from that point forward, if the opportunity ever presented itself, I would drink again. At the age of 16, I'd gotten a part-time job, and the only real responsibility I had was to pay half of my car insurance. So I did what I thought normal teenage boys do, and I spent my weekends drinking and partying. At the age of 17, I'd become really rebellious against my father. After months of fighting, I dropped out of high school and become employed with the company that he'd worked for. I found out in the construction business that there were so many others just like me. And it didn't take long for me to realize that with my father being my boss, that if I laid out of work, he would cover for me. At the age of 18, I fell in love not only with a female, but also with a lifestyle. I told myself that I would soon outgrow it, but that day never did come. At the age of 20, we had two twin daughters, and followed a year later by their younger sister. It was about the time the twins were 3 years old that I found out they biologically was not my children. And man, did this hurt me on the inside. I told myself that I would forgive, but I was soon to find out that I would never forget. In the years that passed, I began to be filled with anger and rage, and I always feared that my children would grow up not to respect me, not being their father. As I got to feeling like this, there would be arguments around the house, and I would leave and go on binges for 3, 4, 5 days at a time. I would lay out of work. I'd put my father's job at risk. And then when I'd come home, my house would be nothing but violence and arguments. I never realized what I was bringing my kids through. Uh, Then in 2008, between 2008 and 2009, I had a series of events that at one time I would consider calamities, but today I consider them necessities. In June of 2008, my brother and I were spending the Sunday together, and before the day was over, me and him had a big falling out. Usually when my brother and I had a falling out, it would only last 2 or 3 weeks and everything would go back to normal. But this one was a much different situation. In the week that followed, I woke up one morning to go to work and the phone was ringing. And when I answered the phone, it was my brother's brother-in-law telling me that my brother had passed away. I was never able to tell my brother that I was sorry. About 3 months later, Tanya had decided that she was fed up with living with me, and she left too. So here I am sitting around, and I'm pondering the loss of my brother, the loss of my family, and I'm watching my mama battle brain cancer. Well, in November, I go to court, and I'm granted temporary custody of my biological daughter. In the weeks that followed, I told myself that I would go out and celebrate. So I took one weekend, and I went out, and I partied all weekend long, a lot of intense drinking, and very little sleep. On that Monday morning, I decided that I was in no condition to go to work, so I called in once again. Sometime around lunchtime that day, it hit me that I should go home and be a father to the daughter that I was battling for in court. So I get ready to leave. I go to the gas station. I go to get some money out of the ATM, get some gas, and I buy a beer. The next day I wake up, I'm in Grady Memorial Hospital to find out that I'd been charged with vehicular homicide and DUI. My father come and bonded me out that following Wednesday. I went home and I told myself that I'd never really wanted to drink again. I laid on the couch. I soaked in self-pity, just thinking about the life that I had taken from another individual. But in the week that followed, I noticed that my habits were slowly progressing right back to the same way they was. I was just justifying it because I wasn't drinking while I was driving. Come December, I was locked up one more time. And I was at the county jail. And at the county jail, you're not allowed to have any contact visits. So I'd been there about a month. And my dad brings my mom in to see me. And he pushes her in her wheelchair. And I pick up the phone. And I'm talking to my mom through the glass. And all I could really think about was, this was going to be the last time I'd ever see my mom alive. All I really wanted to do was hug her neck. In the May that followed, my mom passed away, and I was unable to attend the funeral. So I go to court, and I'm given a 15-year sentence, 10 of which I'm to serve in prison. I finally make it to the prison, and I thought back in times that when I really felt out of place, this was a place that had really made me feel out of place. So I catch myself in prison, and I'm still using at my first institution whenever the opportunity presents itself. In 2011, I'm shipped to Jackson County Correctional Institute, where my life would slowly take a change. In August of 2011, I was able to join the inmate fire department. And it was when I joined the inmate fire department that I found something that I truly love and enjoy doing once again. I caught myself sitting on my bunk at nights, wondering what life would be like if I never took another drink. But then I sat and also thought about, for 31 years, I still had never figured out how to not pick up that first drink. Well, being a fireman in a situation in a prison, you're around the gentleman you're with on the fire department 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, I started bonding pretty close with the gentleman, and he seemed pretty sure about his recovery. The more we talked, the more he talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. So, the meetings were held on Thursday nights, and so one Thursday I took the initiative to attend. And I never will forget my very first meeting. We do our readings, and not long after we get finished with our reading, Roy and Jim walk in, and by looking at the gentleman, they were completely different in every aspect of life. I think that's what made my very first meeting, so perfect. As Roy began to speak, there was a lot of similarities to his story and mine. Roy had been a lot like I was as a child, but what really fascinated me about his story is that he had been in prison too. The most fascinating part about his story was that he had been sober about as long as that I had been alive. And then Jim shared his story, and Jim had never been to prison, just a couple of stints in the county jail for a DUI. But he said so many things that made sense. And when I made it back to my dorm that night, all I could really think about was Roy's story and how much hope I now had that I could one day be sober. I continued to go to the meetings, and week after week, these gentlemen showed with joy. I never will forget the first Thanksgiving after I started attending meetings. After the 6:30 count, the officers would come and let us know it was time for a meeting. But on this Thanksgiving, the sergeant on shift said there wouldn't be no meeting because it was Thanksgiving. We argued with the officer for a second, and he finally let us out of the dorm. And to his disbelief, these two gentlemen showed up. It was at this time that I had felt a love like I hadn't felt in such a long time. Here I was at my bottom, and these two men took time away from their families to come in and share a message with somebody like me. At Jackson County, the way the Georgia Department of Corrections worked, the volunteers there couldn't really have no more interaction with you other than just carrying the meeting. So it was at these meetings that I was able to gain a lot of knowledge about the Alcoholics Anonymous program. But there was still so much more that I was missing. In August of last year, I was shipped to Walker Faith and Character Based Prison, which has truly turned out to be a blessing in my life. I've been able to obtain my MPQ-1 and MPQ-2 firefighter certifications, but most of all, I've finally been given the opportunity to work the steps. Jim is now my sponsor, and for that I am forever grateful. These two men hold a great place in my heart. I can remember when I first started my sentence that how much I hated the system for not letting me, go to my mom's funeral. I hated myself for not being there for my mom. I hated myself for taking the life of another man. Not only had I pulled a father away from my children, but this man would never be allowed to see his children again. And for a long time, it's really built up in me, and I had no way to get it off. But today, I can say that I'm grateful for my prison experience. Because I've realized now that I was bound in chains long before I ever come to prison. Today I look forward to waking up day after day and seeing what God has in store for my life. I'm no longer ashamed of who I am or what I've become. I found a freedom even in my bottoms. I feel like that there's no farther lower that I could go, but I've watched God slowly restore so many things. My relationship with my children are probably better now than they have ever been. The relationship with my father is greater now than it's ever been. And it's in prison where I've truly found joy. I found the firefighters program, I have found AA, and I have found sobriety. Today marks my official fourth year of sobriety. I would just like to take this time to thank Roy and Jim for stepping inside a correctional facility to bring the message to a lost soul like myself. But I would also like to thank Warden Lee and the staff and everyone at Walker Faith and Character Based Prison who has made this dream a reality for me here today. Thank you for letting me share.